The Forum on Workplace Inclusion's 2022 podcast series is sponsored by Best Buy. More diversity in tech means more ideas that can change the world. Learn more at bestbuy.com/moreofthis. Registration is now open to the Forum's 34th annual conference, Solving for X, Tackling Inequities in a World of Unknowns. The Forum on Workplace Inclusion Annual Conference is the United States' largest workplace diversity, equity, and inclusion conference designed for a national and global audience. Maximize your budget and register today by taking advantage of early bird prices, but hurry because our early bird rates won't last forever. Visit forumworkplaceinclusion.org for more information and to register. That's forumworkplaceinclusion.org. Thank you to all our listeners and subscribers. You help support the growth of the podcast and reach new listeners. If you like what you're hearing on the Forum podcast, please consider writing a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you've already written a review, thank you. Please consider sharing our podcast with a friend, family member, or a colleague you think might find value in the content. Word of mouth is the best way the Forum grows, so thank you very much for listening and sharing. Thanks again, and enjoy the show.
Hello, and thank you for tuning into the Forum on Workplace Inclusion podcast series brought to you by Best Buy. I'm Ben Rue, Program Manager here at the Forum. We're really looking forward to today's podcast, The Theory of Racelessness, with Dr. Sheena Mason of The Theory of Racelessness. This is actually Dr. Mason's second Forum podcast. If you haven't yet, I would highly recommend you listen to her first podcast, How Different Philosophies of Race Can Help Us Heal. Dr. Sheena Mason's Theory of Racelessness is a methodological and pedagogical framework for analysis that illustrates how the undoing of racism requires the undoing of race. Her theory inspires a more astute identification analysis of racism. It stops the unintentional reification of racism by ceasing to uphold race ideology and its corresponding language. Theory of Racelessness is also a philosophy of race that extends and explores the boundaries of racial skepticism and delineates more precise paths towards racial eliminativism, which she interprets as enabling us to finally transcend racism. Such transcendence allows us to recognize our individual and collective cultural and ethnic pluralism, a prerequisite awareness that leads society to embracing a genuinely liberal cosmopolitanism. The Theory of Racelessness reflects two philosophical positions on race that are uncommonly taught and commonly misunderstood. Skepticism, the belief that race does not exist in nature, and eliminativism, the position that the concept of race, whatever it is, should be eradicated from human society. The core tenets of the Theory of Racelessness are as follows. Race does not exist in nature. Race does not exist as a social construction. Everyone is raceless. Racism includes the belief in race as a biological or a construction and the practice of racialization. Racism is not everywhere and is not the cause of every perceived racial disparity or negative interaction. We can overcome racism. Her forthcoming book, Theory of Racelessness, A Case for Anti-Racism, under contract with Palgrave Macmillan as part of and an African-American Africana philosophy series, describes, defines, and applies her signature theory to African-American literary studies, a representative case study. In this podcast, you will learn how to identify and define philosophies of race, why we should separate culture, class, and ethnicity from race, and what is the theory of racelessness. In May 2021, Sheena earned her PhD with distinction from Howard University in Washington, D.C. She joined the faculty at SUNY Oneonta in Oneonta, New York in August 2021 as a tenure-track assistant professor in African American literature. Her forthcoming book, Theory of Racelessness, A Case for Anti-Racism, presents a skeptical eliminativist philosophy of race and racism that results in her signature theory of racelessness. Hi, Sheena. We're so excited to have you back. Thank you for being part of our 2022 podcast series. How's your year going so far?
So far, so good. I feel like January is flying by. I'm happy to be here and ending the month with you.
Yes, I can't believe it's already almost February. It's crazy.
It really is. Time flies.
Yeah. My partner was asking about Valentine's Day, and I was like, why are you talking about that? And I'm like, well, because it's almost February. And I was like, oh, God, right, right. That's so crazy. Yeah, so again, excited to have you back. Always enjoy talking with you. Well, we covered a little about your bio in my intro, but I wanted to ask you about your work, specifically around the theory of racelessness. What is it?
Theory of racelessness is a methodological and pedagogical framework for analyzing race and racism, specifically in the American context. So it has tools, something called the race translator, and it has core tenets, and it can be used from classrooms to diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings, workshops, all kinds of spaces and places. And the ultimate goal is to help people free themselves from the problem of racism.
Awesome. Thank you so much for clarifying that. And what are the core tenets of the theory of racelessness?
So the tenets are that race does not exist in nature, and race does not exist as a social construction, which means that everyone is raceless. Racism includes the belief in race as biological or construction and the act of racializing oneself or other people. Racism is not everywhere and is not the cause for every perceived racial disparity or negative interaction, and racism can be overcome. So let me do a deeper dive into each of these tenets to describe and explain a little bit. So the first one being that race does not exist in nature, that's one that most people tend to already come into theory of racelessness knowing or feeling or believing. However, there are some folks who do believe that race is in our DNA, it's biological. I agree with modern science when they tell me that race does not actually exist in nature.
Yeah.
And so part of the work that we do is helping people see that what they translate into race, like skin complexion or hair texture or DNA or ancestry, it's really ethnicity. They're just misnaming something. And the difference matters because whereas there's a handful of racial categories, there are many, 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 many ethnicities. And so helping people outside of homogenizing and washing over all of these differences as it pertains to ethnicity, and thereby unintentionally upholding racist ideas about people, we help people see how race is not in nature. In terms of how race is not a social construction either, so last time we spoke about the philosophies of race, and the first category is naturalism, which I just tended to. The second category is something called constructionism, which is what this second tenet speaks to and disrupts and really highlights what's called my racial skepticism. As a skeptic, I argue that race doesn't exist biologically, and therefore it doesn't exist at all, because most skeptics are skeptical about all social constructions. For them, they tend to be very science-driven. For me, I don't believe in race particularly as a social construction, because what people call race or racial, they're misnaming other things, such as ethnicity, as I just said, or culture, or class, or racism itself, hiding itself as race. So in that way, I'm saying we're just falling into the trap of conceptual errors and calling all of these things race or racial, but we're misnaming other social constructions that do exist in meaningful ways. And we're also misnaming racism itself. And so helping people see that and explore some information that is going to disrupt the notion that it exists in nature or as a construction is part of theory of racelessness work, which then inevitably leads to people recognizing their own racelessness and that of other people's, which is a radical act of recognizing it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Last time we did go into depth about the concept of race and like
what it means to be black or white, or, you know, it makes me think of another podcast by Joe Rogan recently, the uproar recently, when he's, I don't know if you've read or heard about this or read about this, but him being like, what is black? Like, unless someone is like black, you know, then they're like, their skin is actually like charcoal black, then they're not black. And there's, you know what I mean? And it was just like, how do you not understand this? It was the weirdest take on race.
Yeah, he's not alone in that way of viewing the sort of fallacy of race and using colors like white and black as metaphors or stand-ins to describe how somebody looks. Because one of my good friends and a student of theory of racistness and activists in Indiana, he tells people who call him black, like, does my skin actually look black? Is my skin black? So he kind of thinks that in terms of the foolishness of it all, mm-hmm. pointing to the fact that no one is actually, as in literally the color black or literally the color white, that can help disrupt or help people interrogate the concept of race. But I personally don't see it as an effective strategy because it just comes across as too cheeky, obviously too literal. And we all know that, well, maybe not all of us, but many of us know.
Yeah, don't make assumptions. People don't all know. And that's being made clearer and clearer every day these days.
Many people know that, you know, it wasn't initially, the language attached to race wasn't meant to be a literal description, right?
The term black, not being literally black, but more of a cultural thing.
Well, a cultural thing, but initially it was created to justify the enslavement of people who were newly racialized as black, because mm-hmm. race up until, let's say, the 1660s was a concept that existed. It was a concept that existed as a reflection of a class system in early modern Europe, but that system was based largely on like family and ethnicity and nationality, mm-hmm. as opposed to what we now think of as race. And then once we get to the context of the Americas, the concept of race gets reconstructed, reformulated to include white, black, and person of color. And in the early pre-American society, and then after 1776, the words white and black are used to describe political and social status. And if you were racialized as black, that meant that you were enslaved. Mm-hmm. And if you are racialized as a person of color, you were free. So the language that came associated with race was really dictated and predicated upon how much power you were perceived or even afforded in the context of the states. And so when people like Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson, I think that was the same conversation that we're talking about, when they start to question and critique the language that we use as it pertains to race, it's an admirable venture, certainly because it's something that I work with people through my work. But even beside the fact that it's something questionable in terms of it doesn't literally describe a person, I think at the heart of what's more important is the fact that the language and the ideas of it were created to subjugate and oppress certain groups of people. And that's the part that people too often miss when they start talking about crayon colors and things like that.
Yes. Oh gosh. When the beige color was called flesh, which is just, just a weird thing to have on a crayon, period. Like, I don't want to like color with flesh color. That always weirded me out as a kid. It was like, why is this color called flesh? it's just freaked me out. But yes, open that rabbit hole or all of those conversations. And what does a theory of racelessness look like in practice?
So ultimately, a lot of it is sort of corrective work. It's helping people unlearn some common misconceptions about how they conceive of race and what they see as being race. Something you said earlier in terms of Black being a culture, for example, that's some corrective work that we walk people through and we give evidence for, like, this is how race language became conflated with culture. This is why the difference matters and why we should stop conflating the thing. I mean, namely, I think this is something we touched on at the end of our last discussion, namely, because in conflating race with culture, we have this problematic washing over of all of these differences for people who are categorized as Black, and people who are categorized in any racial group. But you and I, we tend to talk about Blackness.
I wonder why. For those who haven't seen us, we're both Black.
We're racialized as Black. I don't racialize myself, but other people.
Well, we are both racialized as Black.
Yes, sir. And so we tend to center that. And what when people start to interrogate, like, what does Black or what does Blackness actually mean? They come to quickly try to assign it to simply racialized Black Americans because they come to recognize that, oh, actually the Nigerian that I would presume is Black, you know, they're culturally different. They don't even often see themselves as Black, right? And if they see themselves as Black, it's because it's a more matter of fact as opposed to speaking about culture or social or politics or ethnicity or anything like that. So we start to deep dive into the categories, and we do this from a raceless or deracialized perspective, meaning because we're operating within this realm of skepticism, I invite participants to view themselves outside of racism. And in doing that, we can then become more clear-eyed and astute in our analysis of racism, namely through our analysis and translation of race when we see it appear in media or when we see it appear in a history book or a literature book. And in doing that, we come to recognize that racism includes the belief in race as biological or construction, and also the act of racialization, which is important because most people tend to define racism as believing in the inferiority or superiority of any race group. But what I help people come to recognize for themselves is the category of race, the concept of race, is the hierarchy itself. So if you believe in the concept of race, you are perpetrating and perpetuating the hierarchy, which is racism. Whereas many people try to assign a moral value or moral judgment to being racist, I help people skip that step, if you will, because it's really a matter of recognizing how one system that is undervalued in the context of the United States is the system of knowledge. It's the belief system. And racism in a lot of ways is systemic because it's in the ways that we come to formulate our knowledge and our beliefs. And in that way, it is inevitable for many people that they're going to have racist ideas, and by extension, they're going to be racist and they're going to be unintentionally upholding racism because of how they're taught racism by being taught race. But once we can recognize that and not see that as saying that any of us is just morally bad or morally righteous because we avoid the pitfalls, then we can see that racism isn't actually everywhere, which is an important step because there are some theorists who would say that racism is inevitable and inescapable. And if it's inescapable and if it's omnipresent, that's how we're going to treat it. That's how we're going to try to problem solve. And we can't solve it because it's everywhere. It's inescapable. It's inevitable. And I try to help show people that it doesn't have to be. Right now it might seem like that, but it doesn't mm-hmm. have to stay like that, because we just have to make different choices, and we just have to stop teaching our young people racism. And in that way, racism can be overcome. So theory of racistness operates from a practical place of hope and optimism in terms of helping people see through the smoke, if you will, mm-hmm. and get to the other side. This results in them being able to liberate themselves from the strictures racism places on all of us. And they can complicate the conversations they have with people in their lives about it. This complicates how they interact with people at the workplace. And I sort of view it as having a downstream trickle effect too, which I think needs to happen if we're actually going to be successful in transcending racism.
That is, yeah, that's deep. And also a little bit controversial, I would say.
A little bit?
understatement. It's very controversial. Because, you know, as you know, there's kind of, we're on the wave, or I don't want to say trend, but because that sounds so, I don't know, belittling. But the current idea is, you know, that we should be focusing on race, and like that's the only way that we'll end racism is acknowledging race and, you know, acknowledging people's different experiences because of their race. But you're saying that we should go the opposite way and talk less about race.
So that's what people tend to hear me as saying, but it's not actually what I'm saying, because...
Okay, thanks for clarifying. I'm sorry. I'm sure I misunderstood, but please clarify.
No, so it's good that this came up, because some people do translate that as what I'm saying. Certainly that would be the goal, because if we're going to actually transcend racism, then we have to transcend the belief in race. Like we mm-hmm. have to eliminate that in order to undo racism. But we can't get there by skipping steps and just pretending that yeah. people don't believe in race, right? So a lot of the work that I'm doing is helping people stop misdirecting the discourse toward the symptom of racism, which is race, mm-hmm. toward the actual root problem, which is racism. And as you come to explore the history of racism, that means you're exploring the genealogy and the history of the concept of race, mm-hmm. which then leads you to the inevitable conclusion that racism masquerades itself as race more often than not. Yeah. As well as the other things, ethnicity, culture, those things get conflated and confused as race, which then allows the machinery of racism to continue to persist. So it's really just about helping people stop misdirecting the discourse. And part of the reason why a lot of people believe that to solve the problem of racism, we have to hyper-focus on race, for example, a big part of the reasoning for that, makes perfect sense if you know the history of racism, mm-hmm. because there haven't been alternative ways to do it. And when people have tried to complicate how we talk or think about race, those perspectives have been, as you said, perceived as controversial. So they get marginalized and excluded and never taught. Yeah. And it's hard to get out of the fishbowl when you're born in the fishbowl. And so people, I think, even on a subconscious level, recognize the sometimes sameness of racism as race, but not enough to recognize how continuing to operate in the category of race precludes us from actually dealing with and solving racism. So from my perspective, it's just about educating people about these matters, showing how these things get conflated and it's on purpose and it continues to perpetuate the problem. But with the right education, with having an alternative like theory of racistness on the table that people mm-hmm. engage with, we can overcome the problem. But so long as we continue to try to do it the way that it's always been done, we're not going to get there. Because part of what I see happening in the fabric of today's society is people convinced that how we're doing things now as it pertains to racism and anti-racism is new. But having studied race and racism in American history and even outside of America, I've really studied on a global scale, I recognize that it's the same old, same old. Like, we are trying to do this the same way constantly and persistently, which is why we haven't gotten out of it. So here's a new way to do this in a way that's proven to be effective. If you read any of my testimonials or my students or my clients, and in being effective, the individual who holds their feet to the fire and participates in my programming, for example, comes to feel that the weight of racism is lifted, literally lifted off of their shoulders. They stop internalizing it. They stop internalizing all of the history, and they feel freer, and they're better able to identify how it still happens today in ways that participating from within race disallow.
Wow, thank you so much for clarifying. Because yeah, I did misunderstand a little bit myself. And I kept thinking about critical race theory and, you know, education right now, and which is, again, it's just heartbreaking to read about education in America right now, because we seem to be going an anti-education way, an anti-learning, anti-talking about issues like this, which is, again, scary.
Yeah, it is scary. And it can be disheartening. And again, the irony for me is that it's nothing new. And yeah. I think most people know that's nothing new, right? But part of the biggest roadblock and hindrance that I see people falling into more often than not is they're dissatisfied with how things have been going. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Check the box, right? They're dissatisfied with the potential directions for how, okay, well, if we're dissatisfied with how things are going, this is the only other way to do it. So people think it's an all or nothing. It's like, we either have to do all of this stuff, CRT inspired type of stuff, mm-hmm. right? Or Kendi anti-racism yeah. inspired stuff, or the opposite, which is to do nothing.
Yeah.
And from my view, I'm over here like, Hey, everyone, here's an alternative that actually gives everyone what they want, except the people who want racism to continue to persist. But I do think that that's a very small percentage of society.
Yeah.
I think more people are closer to the center. They're okay with talking about the history. They're okay with their kids learning the history. They just don't want to be demonized, right?
Yes.
And I think there's something to that. And I recognize that that is not the solution, because so long as we continue to racialize people, then we do unintentionally or intentionally uphold the problem of racism. And no matter which way the racism is cutting, I see that as an error. I see it as a misstep. So our work is not in response to CRT proper or what's being called CRT, but it is timely because I earned my doctorate in May 2021, right around the time when this stuff, thank you, right around the time when this stuff really, really started taking off and being, you know, common conversation. So it's very timely.
Yes, it is very so.
But the tenets, I hope, speak for themselves, especially in the sense that regardless of where a person is starting, they're going to have some level of discomfort with theory of racistness, because mm-hmm. I'm telling everyone when they're wrong, and I'm telling everyone also when they're right. And then I'm helping people come together, you know, and together we can do anything. And I hold on to the goodness of human beings. I'm not a pessimist, or I'm not cynical when it comes to stuff like that, which is why I cannot co-sign the tenets of CRT, like Derek Bell's, you know, racism is inescapable. I just don't believe that.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you continue to believe that, then yeah, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's not going to be escapable.
Exactly.
It's like, yes, if you believe that, then that's what it's going to be.
Right.
So, which is, seems kind of an obvious thing, but again, things are just kind of so crazy right now. 2021, what a year. I did want to, and as you mentioned, like, people not wanting to be demonized, because a lot of times, as soon as you call someone racist, the conversation's like shuts over. Down.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
over. Like, yeah. And like, they are just like, they are not willing to have this dialogue anymore. And you've clearly made up your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, well, this did nothing. so good job. which is why I think that I love the theory of racelessness so much, because it doesn't, you know, demonize people or push them away. I did want to go back and ask about, or something that you mentioned earlier about like people from Nigeria not considering themselves Black, or, you know, until they come here. Because I'm from Liberia, so I don't use the, like, I was born there. So I don't use the phrase African-American, because I'm not. I don't have the same like shared experiences as African-Americans. And to your point, in Liberia, there's no like, it's, you know, like when we're a place where you're the majority, like where Black is the majority, you don't really notice it until it's not an issue, or, you know, something that's really, you know, like you said, it's just a thing. It's not really a thing. So that's why I've used the term Black for myself. What would you recommend?
I think that people should identify however they feel so inspired. And my hope is that by sharing information, more people will feel inspired to not racialize themselves. And that's just my hope, because I see how racism hides itself as race in society, and it obscures and diminishes and devalues other meaningful ways of seeing oneself, such as, you know, in relationship with the nation, in relationship with class and ethnicity and culture. I think that I hear a lot from people around the world increasingly about my work, people in Ireland and England, Canada, and Nigeria in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people tell me that their parents, so some friends that I've been making in Ireland, they're of Nigerian descent. Their parents immigrated from Nigeria to Ireland when they were, you know, toddlers or before they were even born. And when they get there,
Ireland is great. Love it.
I haven't been. I hope to.
Oh, you have to. Dublin is like, everyone is so friendly, and Dublin is just one of the most fun cities. It's a small city, but so fun. Yes, I highly recommend it. My cousin,
I was just going to say, I believe you, because now that I have friends there, I'm going to have an excuse to go.
Do it. My cousin got married there Irish person, which is very interesting because they're from Western Ireland. So like the really thick Irish accents, and my family's from Liberia. And so a lot of people flew in from Liberia to Ireland. Oh. It was just the most interesting group of people. And I don't have an accent. And so actually a lot of my cousins coming from Liberia racialized, and that actually happens a lot, racialized me as white. Like they called me their white cousin.
Exactly. So that's part of what I was going to talk about too. So I've heard from Nigerian descended people in Ireland and Canada in particular, and England in particular, and they all talk about how their parents don't, like, their parents essentially raised them as racist. As they saw themselves as Nigerians, certainly, and having been born in these other countries, they see themselves as Nigerian Irish, you know. They just have a completely different conceptualization of how they are and who they are. And it's troubling to them to see how racism operates in these other countries, because they don't necessarily have the context for it, because it's just not their rate, how they're raised. And then it's ironic to them because they're being put into this category that they didn't sign up for, that they don't really identify with, and they see how racism hides itself as race. So they're like, they kind of take issue with the fact that people are calling them Black, and actually one of these connections I've made, he's spoken about the crayon color stuff that we were talking about at the outset, and to him it's really troubling. He just doesn't get it. But the more people I talk with, the more I learn that in Nigeria, for example, they do have this concept of anyone who comes from overseas is white. Yeah. And they really just attribute it to the sort of otherness in terms of what continent a person is coming from. So you can look any kind of way, but you would be considered white. And in Nigeria, you have Nigerian writers like Chimamanda Adichie writing the book Americana. And Americana in Nigeria is a term for people who are from Nigeria, but they go to a place like the United States, they become racialized and they become sort of indoctrinated, if you will, into race mm-hmm. ideology and other ways of being, and then they're called Americana. And so I think it's ironic because in places where the majority are racialized Black people by Americanized, mm-hmm. if they don't even conceive of themselves in that way, if they don't conceive yeah. of themselves as a majority Black place, for example, if they see themselves more across ethnic lines or nationalistic lines, and then they leave and they get racialized, that to me shouldn't be something that we dismiss just because, oh, they don't, it's because they didn't come up around more racialized white people. Mm-hmm. No, it's because racism exists where there are more groups of people who are racialized in different ways.
Yes.
So to me, that should be our evidence. Like, that should be enough. But I've had people try to dismiss those experiences. People coming from Jamaica get dismissed for having similar feelings about it. And I'm like, isn't that ironic? We talk about listen to Black voices, but if it's a voice like mine,
yes,
or if it's a voice like yours mine. Or somebody else, you know, don't listen to those Black voices.
Those, like, Black voices are white.
Right. Like, we have to listen, make up your mind. You either want to learn or you don't. And if you're sincere about transcending racism, there are alternatives that exist that we that actually get to the root of the problem. And we can learn from other countries where capital R race doesn't travel.
Yeah. It's such a great point. And I, you know, again, coming from Liberia, they refer to different Liberians by their group, like, or like the, or like, you know, like the group that they're in. So like different tribes or villages or, you know, county, you know, where it's like, oh, that person's a crown person and that person's, you know, Grobo person. And, you know, that's how they differentiate people. It's not, or at least like, yeah, by the region they come from. And, but yeah, with people like us who, you know, have left the country, lived in the States or lived in Europe or anything, or by us, I mean my family, like, we are often categorized white by Liberians. Like, one time my mom, a couple of years ago, went there, and she, the place she was staying in got broken into because word had spread that there was a white woman staying there, which is, you know, just their term for, you know, Americans. Even though she is born and raised in Liberia, because she has left and been gone for so many years and now speaks the way she does, and they see her as white, and which is so fascinating. And yeah, it does just prove that race is just kind of a thing that's made, you know, made up.
Absolutely. I was going to ask you, do you get the sense that, because in America, for you or I to be called, in quotation marks, white, it wouldn't necessarily be a compliment, right? Like, there's going to be some kind of value judgment behind that kind of, it would be an accusation almost, right?
Yeah.
Depending on who's saying it. Do you get the sense that there's some kind of value judgment going on in that instance, or?
Oh yeah, definitely. And we talked about this on the last pot, on the last one, but you know, I grew up in a predominantly white community where my white friends would say, oh, you're the whitest Black person I know, and think as though it's a compliment. And then I would have Black people, African Americans call, or African Americans say you're the whitest, or call me white as though it's an insult, like, oh, you're acting white, you're not, acting black, whatever acting white or acting black is. And so it's certain groups see it as a compliment, and then there's the other side who's like, oh, well, you're kind of a traitor to your race, you're acting white, or you act white. And then that's definitely a negative, like, accusation or an attack, which makes no sense to me.
So one thing in my forthcoming book that I really go deeply into is examining and talking about how the category of whiteness gets created. So in this conversation, we center blackness, but it's important to also know how whiteness gets produced across time. And it's largely been produced to be conflated with racelessness. Mm-hmm. So the absence of race is supposed to signal whiteness. Mm-hmm. And it gets conflated with not having to be under the negative aspects of living in a racist society, which to me I translate as being free from racism. It gets conflated with individuality, higher education, and having money, right? Even having access to money, if not actually having money. And so it's super ironic to me that in 2022, when you see a racialized Black person being an individual, right? Like thinking, being an individual, I just mean thinking from themselves and not feeling like they have to follow the mainstream stuff that's happening, or seeing themselves differently, they're accused of being white, because Blackness has been conflated with collectivism, the community. And there are, of course, practical reasons why that would be the case, because if you're racialized Black and you're enslaved, then you have to look out for the bigger group as opposed to just looking out for yourself. But in 2022, because on the ground, the reality is just so vastly different, the ways and the characteristics that get conflated with whiteness and encapsulated, which makes it really inaccessible to every person not perceived to be white, and the stuff that gets conflated with Blackness, theory of racistness is working to explode those categories so that all of these ways of being, and including and especially freedom from racism, are accessible to every single one of us. There's no reason why racistness should have ever been conflated with whiteness, because then it means that any person who tries to get outside of racism who's not white is beat back down and lambasted and accused of being a white supremacist. But it's not about trying to be so-called white, it's about trying to be free from racism. So if we really want that, if we really sincerely want that for ourselves and other people, then theory of racistness is a way to do that. But if we one of my friends says some people like racism the way that it is. If we like racism the way that it is, then we can continue to do what doesn't work.
Yeah, and I mean the definition of madness is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a difference. Different outcome. So if we're going to continue to do the same things to try to fight racism that we've been doing for hundreds of years now that hasn't worked, good luck with that.
Exactly.
I'm so glad we get to touch back on this, because it is such a, I don't want to say awesome, because that just sounds so flippant, but the theory of racistness is, I honestly think, such a revolutionary theory or idea of way of thinking about it. It reminds me, while we were discussing this, I was like, oh, why should I call myself African American or Black when I could just call myself Liberian American, and not talk about race at all, but refer to myself as my origin, I guess, if that makes sense. Also reminds me of the gender fluidity, how that's a big discussion now. And I had a friend who posted this article about being so upset about this celebrity wanting to raise their child gender fluid and being like, and conflating it with being non-binary and being very upset, like, you know, why let the, you know, why is it wrong to tell your child they're a boy or a girl? And I'm like, that has nothing to do with it. That's sex, not gender. Like, gender is, you know, a social construct that says you're a boy, you should do this, you're a girl, you should do this. And being gender fluid or raising your kid gender fluid is just being like, you not saying you should do this, but not saying you, or but saying not saying you can't do this because of the gender or the sex you were born into. Yeah, and like being like, and not being like, oh, you're a girl, so you can't play sports, or you can't play football, or you're a boy, so you can't like dolls or whatnot. It's just like being gender fluid is, or raising your child gender fluid is just allowing them to be themselves and express their gender identity in any way that they want without putting a label on that, which sounds a lot to me sounds a lot like the theory of racelessness. But I could be wrong again. I've been wrong a lot of times in this conversation.
It is okay to be wrong. That's something I help people recognize and embrace too. I can't even tell you. It's my willingness to be wrong that I've continued to grow emotionally and intellectually in the ways that I have. So shout out to you for being wrong. Shout out to me for having been wrong to get to where I am.
Yeah,
I do. I view gender in the ways that you just described. And the important distinction for me between how I view gender and how I view race is that I do view gender as a social construction, whereas I don't view race as a social construction. So there is a difference. And so the solutions to me are different. But in terms of how I aspire to raise my 2-year-old triplets, I have two
triplets.
Boys.
Wow. Yes. I did not know that. Congratulations. And also, wow. Good luck.
Yeah, my wife and I, we have two identical twin boys and our princess Tatiana. And that's definitely the aspiration. It's like, yeah, we want to empower them to have the self-confidence and the tenacity to do whatever they want, you know, in the world and to not put any limitations on themselves for any reason, including, you know, what society might tell them a woman should do or shouldn't do, and so on and so forth. So I think that's spot on in terms of how I also see gender.
Yeah. So, yeah. And yes. And you hear that, audience? I was wrong for you, so you could learn with me.
Exactly.
We're Holland.
Exactly. And that's why we need places where people can actually speak their minds. It's so unfortunate. We live in a society where people are either afraid to be wrong or afraid to be persecuted, that they silence themselves.
Yes.
And they police themselves in a way. And that's to the detriment of our society and our ability to do things. And from what the feedback I get, you know, the diversity, equity, inclusion efforts that are dominant and sort of traditional have this effect where people are just checking the box because they're being forced to participate. So they're just going through the motions, but they're not necessarily getting anything out of it, which to me means that there's not a workplace cultural change. And that to me is the opposite of what we should be striving for. We should be striving to actually have a deep and positive and sustainable impact on people, which will improve the workplace, it improves the culture, which then improves the company's bottom line, which I know to business owners is important. But more than that, it also helps us be better citizens and better people for ourselves and for other people. And that's where I see theory of racelessness intervening, is in that space to let people know how it can be done, how it probably should be done, and actually help people heal some angst and pain as it pertains to racism, as well as help people come together. That's what it's about. And those are the results and the outcomes that we have been achieving.
That is so amazing. And because to like go back to the something you mentioned at the beginning of this, or just now, about how people are so afraid to be wrong that they're just not engaging at all. A lot of racialized white people who are so afraid to be wrong or like ask the wrong question or say the wrong thing and be labeled a racist will go the opposite way and just not interact with their colleagues of different races, or their non-racialized white colleagues because they're afraid. And that also doesn't help at all because then the conversation doesn't start at all.
Yes, and people who aren't racialized as white feel hesitant and tension about interacting with people racialized as white. And it's just all around not the most ideal culture that we can be striving to create in workplaces, because ultimately it maintains this sort of divide across what ultimately people come to find to be very superficial lines. Mm-hmm. And it upholds this idea that our differences are largely determined by how we look, which is mm-hmm. not an accurate reflection of how we participate in culture or our similarities. And if we actually want to have meaningful change and not just be checking boxes, then we have to get creative. And fortunately, there are alternatives.
Yes, the theory of racelessness. Yes. and what were you inspired by at all by Barbara and Karen Fields' concept of racecraft?
So Barbara and Karen Fields, a historian and sociologist, wrote the book Racecraft, The Soul of Inequality in American Life. I want to say it was published in something like 2011. Okay. And I came across the book after I had done my dissertation defense and all that stuff. And I was happy to find the book. I recommend it to every single person listening. It's like $10 on Amazon. It's such a good book. Their concept of racecraft is similar in the sense that they strike me as skeptical eliminativists. So they strike me as people who want to undo the concept of race in order to undo racism. And in the book, they show how in American society in particular, race gets camouflaged. Racism gets camouflaged as a concept of race, resulting in what they call racecraft, which is really speaking to how people, even though it defies logic in a lot of ways, people believe in the illusion or the apparition of race. And when they're trying to talk or deal with racism, they talk about it in the language of race, which then has the unfortunate effect of reifying the concept of race mm-hmm. and not solving racism. And they talk about, One of the sentences and examples they give is something to the effect of the Black Southerners were segregated because of their skin color. So they say time and time again in American life, the cause for racism becomes the race of the individual that's being racialized. In that sentence, the skin color of the Black Southerners is the cause for the segregation. Mm-hmm. And what's missing from that way of talking about it is the action of the racist, racialized white Southerners who are mm-hmm. doing the segregating. So we've got it reversed. We've got the problem reversed, and we've got the cause of the problem being the alleged victims.
Yes.
And that's something I see myself when I see what's happening in today's society and when I take a look at the history of it. And that's that sort of misdirection and racism evasion is something that we work to help more people recognize. And we sometimes use their concept of racecraft to help people recognize what's what and importantly, how to get outside of that problem.
Like she said, everyone, go get Barbara and Karen Fields' book, Amazon, $10.
Yes.
Speaking of books, when does your book come out? You've mentioned it a couple of times now. And what's the title?
Yeah, so thank you for asking me again, because I've since renamed the book. So the title is Theory of Racelessness, A Case for Anti-Racism. My spelling, notice the emphasis on race, the word race is actually in how I spell anti-racism. And I'm anticipating a release by summer. It's reaching the production phase with the publisher Palgrave Macmillan. And they told me to expect it to take about 5 months once it gets to that point. So by summer, it should be out, and maybe I can come back and announce it.
That'd be awesome. I would love that. Definitely have to let us know the date. I say, yeah, just in time to read on a beach or by a pool or
yes,
slow day inside.
Yes, exactly.
That's great. And congratulations on that. That's really exciting. So unfortunately, we're at that time where we have to wrap things up, but it's been such a pleasure having you back and having this conversation. And as you've all heard, I've learned so much, even though we had this conversation, close to this conversation a year ago.
Thanks so much, Ben. It's always fun chatting with you. I appreciate you.
Yeah, I appreciate you and everything that you're doing. It's literally, like I said, just so amazing, so revolutionary. And lastly, I just want to ask, how can people contact with you, you know, and learn more about your work?
You can find us at theoryofracelessness.org. And from there, you can find links to my publications. You can find a link to my podcast. You can find a link to my Twitter, Sheena Mason, PhD. Find me in all the ways, theoryofracelessness.org.
That is so awesome. Yeah, so a lot of ways to contact Dr. Mason. So definitely feel free to do that, and I guarantee you will not regret it. Thank you again, Sheena, for coming back, and I hope you have a great day. And I'm just still thinking about the triplets. And with lockdown and everything, I can't even. I just want to say Godspeed.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Sheena, for this wonderful and enlightening conversation. And thank you to our listeners and our sponsor, Best Buy. To learn more about the theory of racelessness, you can email Dr. Mason at sheena@theoryofracelessness.org or visit www.theoryofracelessness.org. New episodes of the Forum podcast are available at forumworkplaceinclusion.org/podcast. You can also find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, and Stitcher. Thank you again for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you again for listening to the Forum and Workplace Inclusion podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get updates in the latest episodes. Also, tell us what you think by reviewing our podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback. For more information, visit us at forumworkplaceinclusion.org or search Workplace Forum on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you very much and have a great day. The Forum on Workplace Inclusion podcast is recorded at Augsburg University in Minneapolis, Minnesota. One of the most diverse private colleges in the Midwest, Augsburg University offers more than 50 undergraduate majors and 9 graduate degrees to 3,400 students of diverse backgrounds at its campus in the vibrant center of the Twin Cities and nearby Rochester, Minnesota location. Augsburg educates students to be informed citizens, thoughtful stewards, critical thinkers, and responsible leaders. An Augsburg education is defined by excellence in the liberal arts and professional studies, guided by the faith and values of the Lutheran Church, and shaped by its urban and global settings. Learn more at augsburg.edu.